We're back to Job. Mankind's relationship with gold has always been a little extreme. Of all the 118 elements in the periodic table, and by the way, how many of you ever had to memorize the periodic table at some point in your education? Yeah. How many of you have ever used the information you gained from memorizing the periodic table in real life? Like two. I remember when I was a junior in high school, Dr. Chalo in my chemistry class made us memorize the periodic table, and it was actually half our midterm. You had to sit there and fill out the periodic table, and even as a kid, I could remember thinking, I will never use this again in my entire life, and I'm no prophet, but I have never used that again in my entire life. But gold is on the periodic table. And gold is the one element that most people, most of us who don't even use the periodic table, can identify. It is the one element we have preferred to use for jewelry, for ornamentation, as the basis for measuring individual wealth and even the wealth of nations. When athletes compete in the Olympics, they're not running for the tin. You know, they're not running for the copper. They're going for the gold, and anything else is less than ideal. Why? Why gold? Why not zinc, number 33 on the elemental table? Well, there are a number of explanations given. For one thing, gold doesn't rust or tarnish. You know that? Gold, real gold, doesn't rust or tarnish. So ladies, if you go home today and you take off that gold bracelet or gold necklace your husband gave you for your birthday or Christmas or your anniversary, and there's a ring around your neck or your wrist, you've got a skin condition. It's real gold. So I covered that. It's durable. Gold is extremely durable. It can only be destroyed under very high heat. And so if you're wearing something made of gold and it gets hot enough to destroy that gold, you don't need to worry. You would have been dead for a long time. You can't stand that heat. It's malleable. It can be easily shaped. But most of all, we love gold because it's pretty. Yeah. All that glitters is not gold, but gold glitters, and it's pretty. It is estimated, and I don't know where they get this estimate, that 363,762 pounds of gold have been mined off the earth throughout mankind's history. 363,762 pounds. The first time I saw that figure, I thought, yeah, shot in the dark. But that's kind of an industry standard. In the mining industry, that's the standard. That is enough gold to fill one Olympic-sized swimming pool, just one, top to bottom, front to end, side to side. Or, to think of it another way, over 320,000 of those wading pools you get at Walmart. I'd go with the wading pools. I think it would be more dramatic. Every year, fortunes are made and lost dealing in gold, seeking gold, mining for gold, and demand has never flagged. Now, God has a different take on worth. God created the 118 elements on the periodic table. And even as I said that, I think, you know, it could have been worse. God could have created 1,000 elements on the periodic table. I would have failed that test. But for one who has created all the elements, God really doesn't seem to have a lot of use for gold apart from a building material or pavement. You know, when you read about it in the Bible, it's building material or pavement. But there are some things that God values, and they are things that do not appear on the periodic table. One of those things is wisdom. God values wisdom. In fact, while we segregate a number of books in the Bible and call these the books of wisdom, the reality is the Bible is a compendium of wisdom from the beginning of Genesis through the end of Revelation. It is the greatest collection of wisdom ever reduced to writing. God values wisdom. Now, the book of Job, of course, falls into that category of a book of wisdom. And if you think back over the last 27 chapters, you realize that wisdom has been in short supply to this point. Job occasionally gets close. His friends occasionally brush up against wisdom. But the reality is, wisdom is few and far between. The wise statements are few and far between through the first 27 chapters. As we begin to segue away from those 27 chapters, we get a lot closer to wisdom because we're a lot closer to the pronouncements of who? Of God. We'll get to those. Today we look at chapter 28. Chapter 28 for Job is really the high water mark for the book until the very end when he kind of comes to grips. But Job has been climbing this mountain, seeking wisdom, seeking answers, desperate to find a rationale. And in chapter 28, he steps back and he does almost a homage to wisdom. He talks about the transcendence of wisdom, the worth of wisdom. But right before he gets there, it's almost like it's Mount Everest and Job is climbing and he's climbing and he's climbing and there's wisdom at the top. Right before he gets there, he steps off the side and in verse 29, or chapter 29, he just falls. He goes into free fall. That doesn't take away from chapter 28. Chapter 28 is a very insightful chapter when it comes to wisdom. So that's what we're going to look at today. We could call it Job's last lucid interval before he drops into madness, because he certainly starts spiraling downwards. But I like to think of it as Job's homage to wisdom. Now, without bogging down, there is some dispute among theologians about the timing and placement of chapter 28. I wouldn't even mention this, except as I did my research for this chapter, it kept popping up. So I thought, well, I should at least mention it. Although if you've ever researched anything about the Bible, you know there's disagreement about every verse, every chapter, and every book of the Bible. Just depends on who you read. But some theologians argue that chapter 28 was actually added to the Job narrative maybe as much as 200 years later. They argue that someone came along and said, you know, there's such a difference between chapter 27 and chapter 29, we need a buffer in there. We need something that'll bridge 27 through 29. And so it must have been somebody else. It must have been a later commentator, a later theologian who came in and just kind of wrote chapter 28 and force-fed it into Job. That's simply not true. There is no credible reason to believe that. And again, we're not going to spend much time here, but if you look at chapter 27 and 29, the only person ever mentioned in either of those two chapters is Job. So you don't need a transition to figure out, well, how did we get to these different characters in chapter 29 when it was Job in chapter 27? There's no need for a transition. The language is the same. The language that's used in chapter 28 is basically the same language that Job uses throughout the rest of the book. There's a book in the New Testament where the argument over authorship kind of centers around language. What book is that? Hebrews, that's right, the book of Hebrews. You know, the argument of, is Paul the author? Is someone else the author? One of the biggest arguments is, look at the language. It doesn't track Paul's language. But the language of chapter 21 is Jobian language, if you will. And the theme is the same. Chapter 28 deals with the search for wisdom. It deals with the value of wisdom. And Job has spent 27 chapters trying to find answers, looking for wisdom. So for our purposes, and I think the best arguments, are that chapter 28 is exactly where it belongs, between 27 and 29, and it's part of the original Jobian narrative. Now that said, Job 28 presents one of the most important revelations in the entire book. And it's a revelation that you and I already know, but it's a revelation that we tend to disregard in difficult times. In times where we're searching for answers and don't seem to come up with any. Here's the revelation of chapter 28. There are no answers to life's big questions apart from the wisdom of God. There are no answers to life's biggest questions apart from the wisdom of God. That's the reality. That's the reality. There are many things that many questions we can answer, but for the really big questions, why are we here? Why do good men suffer? What is the end of all men? What is the beginning of creation? What is my function here? There are answers that are questions, rather, that we can only get through the wisdom of God. Now, here's the tension. Here's the tension. Even knowing that, does God always choose to answer the question? No. There are questions that will be unresolved individually. That's the tension of Job, isn't it? That's the tension. So, with that in mind, let's look at Job chapter 28. Even though my Bible is open to Psalm 43, we're going to go back to Job 28. Because I know it's right before Psalm. And we're going to look at this. Now, verses 1 through 11 in Job 28 set the stage. Here's the basic theme of the first 11 verses. Job is building to the value of wisdom. And in the first 11 verses, Job is saying there are things of value that men can acquire through their own efforts. But true value, infinite value, comes only from God. If we had to summarize those first 11 verses. So let's look at the first few verses. He begins with a lesson in mining and economics. Job says, verse 1, there's a mine for silver. There's a place where they refine gold. Iron is taken from the dust. Copper is smelted from rock. He begins with the value of gold and silver, the two most valuable metals most of us can name. Why is gold so valuable? I mean, it's what? It's scarce. One of the reasons gold is so valuable is it's scarce. There's, you know, it's supply and demand, isn't it? And gold is simply scarce. What's another reason it's so valuable? It's what? It's what? It's useful. There's utility for it. It's useful. But let's be honest. Does gold have a use beyond what we've invented for gold? Other than decorative, isn't there a better substitute for gold in just about everything we use gold for? I'm not an anti-gold person. But there is a use. It's rare. It's scarce. How easy is it to find gold? Can you find gold all over the place? If we go out, when we started digging the foundation for the new sanctuary, do you think we struck gold? No, we did not, unfortunately. We didn't even pull a Jed Clampett and hit bubbling crude. And we're in Texas. We could have used a little of that Texas tea. But no, it's inaccessible. And because it's inaccessible, it requires a skill set to find. Not everyone can find gold. How many of you watch any of those shows on like the History Channel that, where people are mining for gold? Yeah, I do. I watch all of them. I drew the line when one guy went to South America this year to pan for gold. I didn't, but if they're up in the Yukon, I'm with them. If they're out on the Bering Sea, I'm with them. Cindy keeps watching to see if I'm going to pack a bag. I'm not crazy. But it takes a skill set. You have to have a skill set to either find the gold, or you have to have a skill set to earn money to buy it from people who have found it. So gold and silver are valued, among other things, because they're scarce, they're useful, they're inaccessible, and it requires a skill set. And look at verse 2, it says, there's also iron and copper. Those are valuable. They're strong and durable. Look at the language of extraction. What do you have to do to get copper? You have to smelt it, yeah. And to get iron, you have to take it from the dust. Again, it's inaccessible. If you want to find copper, you either have to go and start digging for it and refining it and putting it into usable form, or you have to find an abandoned house and strip it out of the walls. I don't know any other way. That's not true. I hear people do that. This heightens their value. Even copper and iron that have a lesser value, we value them. We look at them. Look at verses 3 and 4. It says, man puts an end to darkness, and to the farthest limit he searches out. He searches out the rock in gloom and deep shadow. Man has to go to great depths. How does man find these minerals? Are they just laying on top of the ground? Not at all. Man has to dig for them. If you want gold, if you want silver, if you want iron, if you want copper, you have to dig with them. And Job is saying, not only does man do that, they're happy to do that. They're happy to do that. He has to travel. Look, he searches them out to the farthest limit. You can't go in your backyard and start digging for gold. Well, actually, you can. If you own the property, you can go in your backyard and start digging for gold. I could do that. I wouldn't get very far, and I better have a ladder because I don't think my wife's going to pull me out, but you could do that. he will do anything. The point is, Job is saying man will go anywhere and do anything to get what he deems valuable. And he can find the gold. Look at verse 4. It says, he sinks a shaft far from habitation, forgotten by the foot. They hang and swing to and fro, far from man. Who's the they? Who is he talking about? Yeah, the miners. The minor 49ers. And they swing to and fro back in Job's day. And remember, this is back in the time of the patriarchs, during the time of Abraham. The most common way to get in and out of a mine shaft was to be lowered by ropes or vines. And when your time was up, you would be pulled up out of that shaft. Guess what? In third world nations, that's still the primary way they access those mines. Those miners are still lowered by ropes, children lowered by ropes down into these deep mine shafts where they labor with very little light and very little ventilation. So the next time that you think your job is bad, think, I could be mining for manganese in Malta. You know, I could be at the end of a rope. Job is saying it happens. The good stuff, look at verse 5. It says, the earth from it comes food, and underneath it is turned up as fire. Job is saying the good stuff is hidden. It's underneath the earth. It's only revealed by fire. What's he talking about when he says fire? They melt it down, but that's after you get it. How's it revealed? Job's talking about explosives. Yeah, Job's talking about explosives. And I think it's very interesting. I don't know about you, but when I was in school in history, they said, well, fireworks and explosives really originated with who? Yeah, the Chinese. The Chinese. And it was always like 200 BC or 100 BC. The miners are using it back in Job's day, back in Genesis. They'll do anything. The good stuff is not obvious. 6, its rocks are the source of sapphires. Its dust contains gold. Verse 7, the path no bird or prey knows, nor has the falcon's eye caught it. The proudest beasts have not trodden it, nor has the fiercest lion passed over it. What Job is basically saying is that man is the only one who possesses the skill set necessary to seek out what's valuable and to recognize it when he finds it. And man puts great, great effort into it. Verse 9, he puts his hand on the flint. He overturns the mountains at the base. He hews out channels through the rocks. He dams up the streams from flowing. And what is hidden, he brings to the light. Basically, Job is saying, what will man do in order to get what's valuable? Anything. Man will do anything. He will exert any effort. He will go anywhere. He'll engage in any activity, no matter how dangerous. If it's truly valuable, man will go after it, because man has a limited ability to determine what is valuable. Here's the key, verse 12. Job says, after looking at everything man does to gain value, things of value, he says in verse 12, where can wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Job asks the question, with all of man's skill set, with all of his power, with all of his determination, with that box of dynamite that Wile E. Coyote uses, can man access anything of infinite value? And Job says the answer is no. Verses 13 through 19, Job says man does not know the path of wisdom. In verse 13, he says man doesn't know its value. It's not found in the land of the living. Job says that wisdom is not found in creation. It's not found among us in the land of the living. So unlike postmodern teaching, Job says you can't just look around and find wisdom. And it's beyond creation. Verse 15, or rather 14, the deep says, it's not in me. The sea says, it's not in me. It's beyond creation. So it's not modernism. Verse 15, it says, pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, which means, and nor can silver be weighed out in its price, which means what? When it comes to wisdom, what's the price for it? There's no price. Yeah, it's beyond, it exceeds man's capacity to purchase. 16, it cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx, or sapphire. And verse 17 says, gold or glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for articles of fine gold. Job is saying, first of all, you can't buy wisdom. Can you buy information? Sure. Can you buy knowledge? Yes, you can buy data. But Job says you can't buy wisdom. And you can't even compare wisdom to anything else. You can't say, I mean, Ben Franklin said, an ounce of prevention is worth a what? Pound of cure. I don't know where he came up with the exchange rate, but we'll just say he's right. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Job is saying you can't compare. In verse 16, it looks as you can't be valued in the gold of Ophir or in precious onyx or sapphires. What Job is saying is you can't compare wisdom to anything but wisdom. You can't say a little wisdom is worth a lot of gold, or an ounce of wisdom is worth 20 pounds of diamonds. Job is saying wisdom is so unique, it is so valuable, that it can only be compared to wisdom. You have to match wisdom against wisdom. That's how you determine its value. Anything else is like comparing apples to oranges. That very familiar saying, which actually arose, you know, that saying arose in 16th century England, and oranges actually meant oysters. So the saying was actually, it's comparing apples to oysters. There, if you don't remember anything else, that's apples to oysters. But Job is saying to compare wisdom to anything except wisdom is foolishness, because wisdom is so unique, it is so rare, it is so valuable. See how he's building? That you can only compare wisdom to wisdom. Verses 18 through 20, what can man find? He can find a lot of stuff. What can he find? Gold. What else? Yeah, coral. Crystal, topaz. Man can find a lot of things, but wisdom is beyond his reach. This goes back to Job's commentary on what makes gold and silver so valuable. It's that it's inaccessible. It's about supply and demand. It's inaccessible. So what gives its unsurpassed value? You know, while we look at this, and we have thousands of years between the writing of Job and today, this is groundbreaking thought. Job is saying when it comes to wisdom, all his friends are saying we're wise. And his friends are counseling him based on their wisdom, which is the wisdom of who? Which is the wisdom of man. But you know, that's about all the world has to go on is the wisdom of man. But Job has recognized that there is a greater wisdom, that is something, but it's not true wisdom. And that is a monumental recognition. Job realized he's searching for something that really just can't be found. Look at verses 20 through 27. This is the path to wisdom. Job says, so where does wisdom come from? Job knows it's out there. Where does it come from? Verse 21, it's hidden from the eyes of the living. It's concealed from the birds of the air, of the sky. Abaddon and death say, with our ears we've heard of it, but it's not here. Job says that it's not in the living. You can't observe wisdom in our day-to-day lives. Birds can't even see it. Why do you think Job keeps coming back to birds? What were birds viewed as? Back in Job's day, think about it. They didn't really have telescopes. They didn't have binoculars. So it was generally considered that birds possessed the sharpest eyesight on the planet, and that they could fly around and look around for miles at what was going on, and men would envy that. And Job is saying, even with that, the birds can't even see it. It's not among the living. It's not in the afterlife. Abaddon, death and hell, it's not there. They say, we've heard about it, but it's not here. Death and hell, what segment of the population does that refer to? Obviously, the dead segment. The redeemed or the unredeemed? Those are the unredeemed. Yeah, Abaddon, death and hell. Isn't it interesting to realize that in eternity, you and I will grow wiser and wiser by the day as we sit in the presence of God. We will be exposed to that wisdom. And through our exposure, we'll learn more and more about God every day, every minute. But in death and hell, there is no wisdom. The unredeemed will go through eternity not only in torment, but in foolishness. They will never grasp wisdom. It simply doesn't exist in death and hell. Job recognizes that there are things that man is uniquely equipped to access, but wisdom isn't one of them. But let's be honest, does unredeemed man even seek wisdom? I mean, Job is extolling the value of wisdom, but does unredeemed man even seek wisdom? How many say no? How many say yes? How many say, you know, we ran out of donuts real fast today? I think we could all say amen to that. No. Well, this is a Rich Dewey question. Because the answer is, now that I've told you it's a Rich Dewey question, what's the answer? Yes and no. Man does seek wisdom. Man seeks wisdom. I mean, we have institutions of higher learning. We have libraries full of books. We have all sorts of individuals who are seeking wisdom. But what kind of wisdom does unredeemed man seek? It's the world. It's the wisdom of man. Yeah, it's worldly. It's the wisdom of man. That's all they know to seek. That's what they seek. And because they seek that wisdom, do they ever come up with the answers to life's really big questions? Not at all. Yes, man can use a type of wisdom to come up with the internal combustion machine engine. Man can use certain types of wisdom to build great skyscrapers. There are things man can do that God has allowed man to do. But when it comes to true wisdom, wisdom of infinite value, the wisdom that it takes to answer the big questions in life, that's not contained in the wisdom of man. So unredeemed man does seek for wisdom. They just don't seek for the right wisdom. Why don't they seek the correct wisdom? The first thing is what? Do they know what wisdom is? No, unredeemed man has no idea what true wisdom is. They seek for answers. It's estimated that for every Christian, I do the air quotes, but for every Christian in the world today, and everyone who identifies them as Christian, there's over 300 people, let's just talk in this country or in this area, but there's 300 to 500 people who are actively involved in what Christians consider cults. But are those people in cults looking for the same answers we are? Yeah, they are. They're looking for answers to life's big questions. Are they going to find them there? No, they're not. Man cannot seek true wisdom, first of all, because he doesn't know what it is. In Ephesians 4:18, it says that their minds are darkened. You can't know what you're looking for when your minds are darkened. So man does seek a wisdom, but he doesn't know what it is. The wisdom of man is what to God? The Bible says the wisdom of man is what? Foolishness to God. So in 1 Corinthians, I think it's 4:20. I'll have to check on that. But in 1 Corinthians, that's an H. A bad shot today. But in 1 Corinthians 1:20, it says that the wisdom of man is foolishness to God. So even when man comes up with what they think, with what we think is wise, God says, not only is it not right, it's foolish. It's foolish. And what does man do with truth? In Romans, Paul says in Romans 1:18, what's man doing when he finds it? He suppresses it. Man suppresses the truth, and the truth is wisdom. Man suppresses the truth, actively suppresses the truth in unrighteousness. So while man, unredeemed man, seeks wisdom, they seek the wisdom of man. They can't identify what true wisdom is because their minds are darkened. What they identify wisdom as is foolishness. God looks at it and says, that's just terrible. That's just pathetic. I remember when I was a freshman in college, I signed up as a chemistry major. I would take offense, but that was kind of my parents' attitude, too. And I took this chemistry test, and my teacher, Dr. Gechner, was also my advisor. And after the first test, Dr. Gechner called me into his office to review the test, and he said, Mr. Beswick, you're a chemistry major? Huh? I said, yes, sir. He said, Mr. Beswick, this is terrible. This is a foolishness. He said, a trained monkey could have done better on this test. I wasn't going to Christian college. I said, well, Dr. Gechner, what would you suggest? Should I get a tutor or just buy a trained monkey the next time? I found out chemists have no sense of humor. But and I'll tell you something, I wasn't suppressing the truth and unrighteousness. I really didn't know the answers. So man, unredeemed man, truly does seek wisdom. Their minds are darkened, though. They can't recognize it. When they find it, it's foolishness. That what they say is wisdom, God looks at it and says, that's pathetic. That's pathetic. And they actively, intentionally suppress what truth God has revealed to them, the truth that is available to them. They suppress that. They don't want anything to do with it. They don't want anything to do with it. Look at verse 23. God understands its way. God understands its way. He knows its place. God has a monopoly on wisdom. When we talk about wisdom, there is no competition. Job says that God knows it, and only God knows it. God knows the way. He understands it. He understands. When we say we understand it, what are we saying? If I say, well, I understand how that works, what am I saying? Yeah, I get it. I comprehend it. You can show me this thing, and I can say, this is how it works. I can explain to you how this works because I understand it. It says that God understands it. He knows its place. God knows where to find it. Look at verses 24 through 26. It says, God looks to the ends of the earth. He sees everything under the heavens. When he imparted weight to the wind and meted out waters by the measure, he set a limit for the rain, we're to 26, and a course for the thunderbolt. He saw it, speaking about wisdom. He saw it, he declared it, he established it, he searched it out. That's what God did. So God sees all and knows all. We call that what? Omniscience. Or Johnny Carson called it? Karnak. Yeah, thank you, Karnak. And everybody under the age of 50 is saying, who? Johnny Carson. Google it. In verses 25 and 26, my humor is not dated. Y'all just need to catch up. My humor is not dated. You're just too young. See, you were. It's like Paul. You were born out of time. There you go. Verses 25 through 26, Job says that God ordains it in all generalities and all specifics. We call that God's what? It's omnipotence, yeah. So Job's talking about omnipotence. In verse 27, it says, God established it. I love this. I love this. He saw it. He declared it. He established it. He searched it out. God saw it. What kind of a witness is he? Eyewitness. That's exactly right. God is an eyewitness to wisdom. God sees what wisdom is. So that means that he is the best one to explain what it is. God sees it. God recounts wisdom. He declared it. What does that mean? God declared it so we know it's accurate. Why do we know it's accurate? Yeah, because God's the one who announced it. He established it. He established wisdom so we know what? Is there any doubt that wisdom is real? No, God established it. He searched it out. That means that God has all the wisdom there is to have. God took the time to search out wisdom. It's kind of like that Indiana Jones, one of the first two Indiana Jones movies, the ones that were worth seeing, where he went for a specific purpose, and he found that thing, and he gathered it to himself, and that was the whole purpose of the trek. We know that God has everything. God has wisdom. So God is the only one who has the right to say what wisdom is and how it's to be applied because he established it. He's an eyewitness to it. He declared it. He searched it out. So what is wisdom? We come to the last verse of Job, one of the most familiar verses in Job. Probably curse God and die and this wisdom verse are the most common. Job says, to man, God says, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. I doubt there's a person here who was raised in a fundamental church who did not memorize that verse repeatedly growing up. The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, to depart from evil, that is understanding. It's not exactly the recipe for Coke, but it'll get us through life. So what is wisdom? Wisdom is the fear of God. Fear of God, there's a number of factors. I suggest these. First of all, it means that we have to know God. Proverbs 2:5, we are to know God. If we don't know God, we're not going to fear God. I mean, that's the bottom line. If you do not fear God, that doesn't mean God's not fearful. That means you don't know God. Because if you know God, you will fear God. If you can glimpse the transcendence of God, you will fear God. Second, in Proverbs 15:33, it says, we're to honor God. That's part of fearing God, is to honor God through obedience. Proverbs 33:8-9 says, we're to have respect for God through the power of his word. But most of all, fearing God means what? Being afraid. Why should we be afraid of God? Now, Tom just gave that really beautiful sermon on why we're not to be afraid of, or our beautiful position as adopted children of God. I have a better story about adoption than he told, but I don't have time to tell this morning. I'll work it in some other time. But, and I'm going to tell him I have a better story. But I won't tell him what it is because it will drive him nuts. No. Why should we be fearful of God? If we can call Abba Father, if we are children, if we have been adopted, why should we still be fearful of God? Why should we have a healthy fear of God? He what? He's not one of us. Who is he? He disciplines those he loves. None of us loves to be disciplined. And you know something? If we have no fear of God, what are we going to do? We're going to do whatever we want, which kicks in the discipline of God. What else? Why should we be afraid? He can destroy the soul, and even though we know that we're not going to be ones destroyed, that still is a remarkable reminder of who he is. I mean, this is God. If we can understand who God is, the transcendence of God, the holiness of God, we should fear crossing that God. We should fear. You know, I loved my father, and I had a great relationship with my father. I loved him dearly. But you know something? I didn't want to cross my dad. Not because he was a child abuser, but you know something? I'd be punished. And I didn't want to cross him because I loved him, but I also didn't want to cross him because I didn't want, as a younger child, to get spanked. I know that's a terrible concept now. Oh, your father was a child abuser. He spanked you. I didn't want to get spanked. I didn't want to get this as an older child. I didn't want to get sent to my room as an older teenager. I didn't want to lose car privileges. I mean, I feared my father. Part of fearing God is fearing God. As Job wraps up, the last line says, to depart from evil is understanding. If we truly fear God, we will demonstrate that by a lifestyle. And that lifestyle will be a conscious abandonment of sin. Not sinless perfection, but a conscious abandonment of sin. As one commentator wrote, there is no accidental wisdom, nor is there any inert wisdom. Wisdom is not accidental, and it's not inert. Wisdom is procured deliberately, and it doesn't just lay there. Wisdom is alive. As we search for wisdom, divine revelation must be our starting point, or we'll never find it. Here's the reality. If we don't fear God, we will always question God. That is a reality of our fallen nature. If we do not fear God, we will always feel free to question God. That's not a healthy relationship. Through Job, God makes this point. Job encounters wisdom through suffering so that you and I don't have to. Job encounters wisdom through suffering so you and I don't have to. Does that mean we'll never suffer? No. It doesn't. Unfortunately, suffering is part of the package. Sometimes severe suffering is part of the package. What I'm saying is, you and I do not have to suffer as Job suffered to learn the same lessons that Job learned, because God's taken 42 chapters to lay out the lessons. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. So, do you want wisdom? Well, fear the Lord. Psalm 111:10 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." Everything has a starting point. With wisdom, the starting point is the fear of the Lord. You want wisdom? Don't just stop with fearing the Lord. Ask for it. What does James 1:5, what does James say? If you lack wisdom, what? Ask. Who do you ask? You ask God. How will God give it? Will God dole it out? Will he drip it out? No, God will give it abundantly. You know, the reality is, God is more anxious to give you and me wisdom than we are to get it. God is much more anxious to give you wisdom and me wisdom than you and I are to seek it. I honestly believe that. When do we most often seek wisdom from God? In when? Yeah, when times are tough, we go for wisdom. Do we need wisdom all the time? Yes, but we ask for wisdom when our backs are against the wall and the knife's at our throat. Two things I hope never happen to any of us. But that's when we ask, why don't we seek wisdom more? Why don't we go to God and ask God for wisdom more often? There's pride. Yeah, pride is absolutely. We really think we can figure it out. You know, if I have an issue, I can figure this out. And pride gets in the way. We wouldn't identify that. We think, no, we're being self-reliant, and I'm using the information that I have, and I'm using the brain God's given me. But it's pride. It's pride that keeps us. What's another reason? Okay, we don't want to bother him. Don't bother God. But we do, I think that means, too, that means that we undervalue the need. We undervalue the need. And I think we forget sometimes that that is a remarkable resource that's available to us. As Christians, we are uniquely provided the opportunity for deific wisdom. Not that we will see, you know, just have, oh, I'm as smart as God. No. No. I mean, Margie, you can say that, but I would never say that. But yeah, we underestimate it. Or unrepentant sin. Let me tell you something. Nothing will stop us from asking for wisdom faster than unrepentant sin. That drives us away from God. So if we want to be wise, fear God. That's where it begins. Ask for it. It doesn't stop there, though. Apply it when you get it. Proverbs 3:11 says, "Let your heart keep my commands." Let your heart keep my commands. Wisdom is just trivia unless it's applied. So when you get wisdom, apply it. Fourth, value wisdom. Treasure it. Honor it. Assign the value God assigns. We don't have time to go to Proverbs 3. I just jotted down in the first four verses, here's what wisdom adds. And this is just in the first four verses of Proverbs 3. It says, wisdom adds to the length of your life. Wisdom adds to the quality of your life. Wisdom provides you with a realistic worldview. Wisdom is a source of joy. Wisdom fosters a right relationship with God. Those are pretty good things. Value wisdom as God does. Next, study the book of wisdom. Again, the Bible is the compendium. Study the Bible. Study the entire Bible. Wade through Leviticus. I don't know why, but there's wisdom there. Wade through. But study the entire book of the Bible, the whole thing. You know, 2 Timothy 3:16 gives us that whole laundry list of what Scripture's good for, but it wraps it up, says that we're fully equipped for every good work. That's wisdom. Finally, hang out with wise people. Proverbs 3:20 says, "He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the company of fools will be destroyed." You want wisdom? Wisdom eluded Job for a long time. If you want wisdom today, though, start with fearing the Lord. Second, ask him for it. Third, when you get it, apply it. Fourth, value it as God values it. Fifth, study the Bible. Sixth, hang out with godly people. There, you do that this week, you will be wiser next Sunday than you are today. That's not a bad goal. The rest of the book of Job shows Job in free fall. Thankfully, God steps in and reveals real wisdom. This week, begin at the source, seek wisdom, fear God, live wisely. Let's close in prayer. Lord God, we thank you that you have all wisdom. Lord, we confess that so often we do not seek it, that we wait for crisis management. And Lord, when things get really bad, then we cry out for wisdom. Lord, help us to value wisdom. Help us to see wisdom as you see it. Lord, grow in us a true fear of you. Grow in us a recognition of who you are. Lord, grow that fear. Not that we have a dread of you, Lord, but that we have a healthy fear of you. And Lord, help us to call out for wisdom. And when we get it, help us to apply it. Lord, help us to value it as you value it. Help us to delve into your word and luxuriate in the wisdom that's there. And Lord, help us to be careful about the company we keep. Lord, may next week we be wiser than we were last week. Lord, may you continue to draw us to you. May you continue to pour out grace upon grace, and that grace includes wisdom. We pray this in your name. Amen.